Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. This particular show is dedicated to the trends and products of the recent Winter NAMM show that just finished up yesterday. So we'll be talking about those. I want to thank everyone who showed up at the Alfred booth for my presentation on new trends in the music business. And also I want to thank Richard Gibbs, the great Al Schmidt, Hanson Hsu, and Michael Beinhorn for sitting with me for some interviews for Lynda.com. And hopefully you'll be able to hear them on this podcast sometime in the near future. That was a lot of fun, though. But let's dive right in. Let's talk about some of the trends of the show. I think one of the things that really caught everyone's attention is Avid introduced Pro Tools 12 and Pro Tools First. And what these are basically cloud versions of Pro Tools. So if, for instance, you don't want to pay the full pop for the app, you can do it in the cloud. And you pay a monthly or yearly subscription in order to do that. Now, the thing about it is you store all your projects in the cloud, which is kind of cool. And you also have the ability to rent any plugins that a project might have. So, for instance, if you're collaborating with someone else and they're using a bunch of plugins that you don't have, you can just rent them for the duration of the project. There's a couple things here. First of all, you're going to have to rent space. I think you only get 3 projects worth of space. So that means if you're going to be storing anything, you're going to have to rent some cloud space. And don't forget, you're going to be renting plugins as well. So besides the monthly fee for the Pro Tools software, you'll also be paying additional charges. So that's kind of where Avid thinks they're going to get you. Another big thing, of course, is collaboration. And there's a lot of companies that are betting that collaboration online is going to be the next new thing. I'm not so sure about that. There are certain cases I can think of. One is if you have a guest artist, for instance, and can't make it to the studio, then this is a great way to do it. Most of the time on a pro session, the producer would rather have the artist, musician, whomever, right there with them. But again, this is a brave new world. That doesn't necessarily happen all the time. Of course, everybody is saying another new version of Pro Tools. I haven't even gotten to the last version, meaning that so many people are still on Pro Tools 10, let alone Pro Tools 11. And Pro Tools 12, of course, people are saying, well, wait a second, why do I need it? Pro Tools First is an entry-level program. That's for people that really don't want to spend the money for Pro Tools. And of course, this just gets them into the family, but at a cost because they're paying monthly. And also the fact that, again, for I think you get 20 plugins, but for anything else, it's exotic. You can rent it, but you know there's the extra charge and the extra charge for storage. Pro Tools, Avid, is not the only one doing this, however. Cakewalk, with their Sonar, also introduced a very, very similar program where it's a membership, and you have either a monthly or yearly membership, or, of course, you can purchase the software outright. I don't know if this will be a trend in the business. Certainly, it's kind of the norm in the tech side of the business, but I would venture to say that most pros are not going to go for it. One of the bad problems, of course, if you're recording to the cloud, you're kind of limited by the upstream bandwidth that you have. And let's face it, a lot of us have a lot of bandwidth coming down. In other words, downloads are really, really fast, but uploads are really slow, maybe a tenth of what we get coming down. So that's a real problem, and it's going to be a limiting factor for a lot of pros. So anyway, that's Pro Tools 12, Pro Tools First, and Cakewalk Sonar. Something else that I saw that was really interesting, walking around the show, the NAMM show is interesting in that there's a lot of activity going on all the time. There are bands and artists and music playing at multiple venues just about all day and all night. That's the cool part. The bad part is most of them were solo artists. Now, they had their own bands, but they were solo artists. There were very few bands there. And I think this is kind of a bad trend. Now, yes, I understand there's always someone who's kind of the director in a band and writes the songs and is providing the direction for the whole band. Yes, that's always happened. But it's the push and pull of a band, of the multiple members, that kind of makes it bigger than what it is. Now that we're going more to the single artist, the solo artist, a lot of that's going to disappear, and I think music in general is going to suffer as a result. Another trend that I saw, at this year's NAMM show was the fact that there were more DJs or more DJ equipment and things were more EDM-oriented than over the last few years. 2008, 2009, at the NAMM show, it looked like this peaked. Everybody was trying to get in, meaning manufacturers. They were all trying to get into the DJ space. And then as of last year, everything seemed to have ebbed back to a low point where there were a few DJ things and DJ-oriented companies and products, but not as much as the years before. But that's all turned around this year. 2015, wow, lots of DJ stuff. Probably Pioneer had the biggest splash because they had a huge booth that was dedicated to their DJ gear. And of course, right next to them was Denon, who had everything dedicated basically to DJs. And there was a lot of other DJ-oriented gear around the show. So that's on the upswing, and it probably means that electronic music and EDM is as well. Another trend that sort of plays into that are modular synthesizers. Downstairs in Hall E is what we call Inventor's Row, because it's little mom-and-pop companies. They kind of have an idea. They can't afford to go upstairs in NAMM, so they go downstairs where it's cheaper. And usually find the neatest stuff down there because there's people that are kind of cutting edge. That's a little less so these last few years, but that's the way it normally is. And what we saw over the last few years happening down there was a lot of these small modular synthesizers. These are really small modules and really small little racks and very inexpensive. And there would be, basically a 10 by 20 booth where all these manufacturers kind of gathered. This year, that whole thing exploded. There were multiple booths, both downstairs and upstairs. And I would say it probably went up by a factor of 5 or so. So people are really getting into this, little modular synth modules. I think it's a great trend because it teaches people about synthesis on a very, very granular level. And of course, it's fairly inexpensive to get into. Playing into that as well is the fact that Moog also reintroduced their big modular synthesizers, which kind of been out of fashion forever. And of course, Moog hasn't made them in maybe 30 years, but now they're back and they showed them a number of different models and a number of different modules that you could actually buy. So if you wanted a real Moog modular synth, you can now have one. Another trend that was very interesting was Gibson. Gibson, we know, is a guitar company. However, they actually showed more of a lifestyle side. They had a huge room upstairs. Now, of course, NAMM, there's basically four levels. There's the main four halls, there's the downstairs basement, and there's two upper floors. And the upper floors generally have guitar companies and piano companies. Guitar companies like Taylor, Line 6, you'll see Ampeg is usually up there. Fender and Gibson are usually up there. And you'll have all the piano companies there as well. Well, Gibson had a huge room, and usually it's filled with guitars, and everything is guitar-oriented, but not this year. This year, guitars kind of took a back seat to everything else. Now, first of all, understand that Gibson has acquired a lot of companies in the last few years. Teac Tascam, KRK, Onkyo, Stanton, Serwin Vega, Philips. That's just off the top of my head. But now, at this show, it looked like they were trying to emphasize lifestyle gear. Lots of headphones, lots of players, turntables, radios, all sorts of things that were very lifestyle-oriented. It was quite unusual. They even had something that they called B, a product line, which had big black and yellow stripes. It looked very Chinese or very Asian. It looked like it was for that market. Quite unusual. So if anything, it looks like Gibson was trying to go into that market than the other way around. My guess is that Gibson is trying to be another Yamaha or Sony or Samsung, a company that spans a lot of different product areas and has a lot of different products in each of those areas. And good for them if they can pull it off. They haven't been really successful in recent years with their acquisitions. Generally speaking, they acquire a company with some great technology and the company and the technology disappears after a few years. So let's hope that doesn't happen with the recent companies that they acquired. Speaking of China, Chinese musical instrument companies were everywhere. China's had a big impact on the NAMM show over the last few years. but no more so than this year. About half the downstairs booth space was for the Chinese delegation, which is quite a lot. But not only that, there were Chinese companies that were scattered in all of the other halls as well. The interesting thing is they don't seem to be selling a lot. There's not a lot of action around the booths, and you don't see dealers there all that much. And generally speaking, you see, you know, a bunch of Chinese men and women, they're sitting around talking to one another inside each booth. The other thing you see is that most of the companies really have knockoff products, but not even of recent products, like older products. So for instance, you'll see a 31-band EQ, and it will look like an EQ that was kind of from the 90s maybe. And you'll think, oh, wait a second, things have come a long way since then, so they don't even have last year's knockoff. Lots of knockoffs of microphones like the Beta series from Shure and SM57s and 58s and what looks like various Neumanns and things like that. And it kind of bugs me, the fact that there's no innovation. If they would have some very new and cool products, then perhaps they'd get a lot more attention. Now, there was actually one possibility there. Happened to be looking through the NAMM magazine. There's a daily magazine with basically press releases that comes out. And there was a product by a company called Cherub, you know, like the angel, and it was called an infrared drum tuner, which I was very intrigued in. I think that's a great idea. So I searched through the whole show in order to find this company, little company, and they had a couple of them there under glass. You couldn't see if it worked or not. There were two Chinese people there that seemed to care less that I was looking at it and really didn't want to engage with me, unfortunately. But the theory behind it is cool. Basically, what happens is it shoots an infrared beam at a drum head. And from there, it can tell how fast it's beating, obviously, and it can equate it to a note. So this could be a way for drummers to easily tune their drum heads. And I think this is a great idea, at least conceptually. We'll see if they can actually make it work. And I have my doubts that it was actually working at the show, or else they would have been showing it that way. Something else that I saw at the show, and this is kind of funny, there were a lot of people that were dressed up in costumes walking around, costumes kind of like the guys from Gwar or Slipknot, masks and just weird get-ups. Don't know what to make of that. I don't know if nu metal is coming back or if it's an extended Halloween or what, but it sure was interesting. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can find out more by going to 101mixingtricks.com. Let's get into gear. There was a lot of gear at the show, and you're going to hear about it from other places. So I will tell you the things that caught my eye, and chances are they're out of the norm. It's not what you're going to hear from other places. Some of it might, but some of it you won't. So let's get into it. The first thing I saw, maybe the coolest thing of the show, was a little Trident 500 module called a high-low. And basically, it was a high and low-pass filter set. And there are two cool things about it. First of all, the filters, the filter frequencies overlapped. It's kind of unusual. Usually, they go to a high of 200 cycles, or the high-pass filter and the low-pass filter comes down to maybe 5K or something like that. But these could pass right over one another. And that was kind of cool. But the other thing is they were tracking. They were dynamically tracking filters. Now, usually this is done in software, any kind of tracking. In other words, the filter frequency changes with the program. Now, any kind of tracking like this is usually done in software. It's not done in hardware, so I don't know how they're doing it. As a matter of fact, I don't even think they were showing this module. They showed it to me kind of like, hey, this is what's coming out. So this is Trident, Trident Audio Developments, people that make the Trident consoles. Other thing that was kind of neat, there was an EQ by a company called Apora, A-P-O-R-A, and it was kind of a Pultec Tube EQ knockoff, but it didn't have any knobs on it. It was called a Behemoth, and it was a fully resettable EQ. So in other words, you can set your EQ parameters up, and it would remember them, which is kind of cool. It could also have numerous parameters from various studios or engineers or whatever, and those are programmed in. So that was kind of cool. It was really big and bulky and very red. As a matter of fact, you can't really find out information about it online because their website just points to the NAMM website. But anyway, I found it intriguing, so look for that. Apora Bohemoth, it's called. ADK, which I really like their mics a lot, and they have a Z series, which has interchangeable capsules. They came out with a preamp for the capsules, and this is a tube preamp. And it was basically because a lot of people liked the sound of their C12 or U67 capsule, but of course the solid-state preamp doesn't really go with that too well, so they came out with the tube preamp in order to complement it better. So that was kind of cool. Something else that was really interesting, it was, again, one of the cooler things I saw at the show, was something called a Mackie Freestyle. They were billing it as a personal PA system. It was about the size of a boombox. It would work on batteries, and it had two mic line inputs, some DSP for effects, and also a feedback suppression circuit in it. Very cool. And to top it all off, you can control it from an iPad iPhone app. Really cool. It's about $400. If you want it, you can carry it and use it for busking, for instance. But it also had a little kickstand that you could face it backwards, looking up at you, and make it work as a little monitor. So I don't know what it sounded like, but it looked kind of cool. That was a Mackie Freestyle. Line 6 had something very, very cool. Of course, they've been making wireless mics and wireless guitar packs for a while. And they had a wireless guitar system that was very neat. It had a couple of neat features. One of the things that happens with guitar players is we like to change guitars. And if you're changing, for instance, from one guitar to another, let's say it's from an electric to acoustic electric, and you have two wireless packs, you're going to need two transmitters, two receivers. Line 6 got around this by allowing two transmitters to work at one receiver. But it's even better. It's more dynamic. It will actually sense when you take a guitar off and you put it down. It will sense that and will automatically switch to the other transmitter on the other guitar. Behringer had all sorts of really, really cheap stuff that was iPhone and iPad oriented. And the one that caught my eye was called the X-Air series. And there was an especially little one called the XR12. It was a little 12-input mixer with a few controls on the front, but mostly input and output connectors. And, of course, it was Wi-Fi, so you could talk to it through your iPhone or iPad. Very, very cheap, $300 for 12 inputs. This looks to be the future of sound reinforcement. Everything seems to be going that way. And, of course, Presonus and Behringer and Allen & Heath all have new units that are like that, where you basically don't have controls on your console anymore. It's all done from an external tablet or phone. Glenn Coleman is one of the treasures of the music business. He's been around for a long time, from his days at MCI, the old console tape machine company. I think he worked at the record plant for a while, the old record plant, and he's been developing tools for engineers and studios for a long time. And he came out with something that's very cool. It's called the Phone Mix DI. What it will allow you to do is to interface your iPhone or your Android phone or whatever phone it is to your console. So basically, it gives you a pair of XLR outs. But there's also a headphone preamp on it, and there's also another input. So you can mix between the iPhone and between another input, a guitar or whatever it might be, and listen to it at the same time via the headphones. So this is a very versatile box. It's very cool. I think it was about $450. Blue Microphones came out with a new mic called their Hummingbird. And what this is a cardioid condenser, small diaphragm condenser. Lots of those out there, but this had a swivel head. It allowed you to swivel the head 180 degrees. For those of you who remember, this used to be a feature of the AKG 451. It was an accessory that you could buy. And we always used them in the studio a lot if they were available, because what would happen is you can get into really, really tight spaces, especially like between the snare drum and hi-hat, just all sorts of tight spaces with this because that head would swivel. So anyway, Blue Hummingbirds now have this feature, and they're fairly inexpensive, $300, $299. Check that out. And speaking of DIs, Ampeg came out with a bass DI called the SCR-DI. And what it has in it is a scrambler circuit. Of course, Ampeg has been making a scrambler foot pedal for a while, which is kind of like an overdrive, especially for the bass. So that circuitry is in there, as well as a lot of tone shaping control. And of course, there's also a headphone jack. So there's a headphone amplifier on it. And there's also a stereo aux input. So you can use it as a practice device as well. It's very cool. It's about $200. D'Angelico guitars have been known for some of like the best jazz guitars ever. And they've been around, I think, since the 20s or 30s. They changed everything up this NAMM show, though, and came out with a line of solid and semi-solid body guitars that look kind of like 335s and Les Pauls and the legendary guitar body styles. Brad Whitford from Aerosmith is one of their first endorsers, which is kind of cool. But anyway, I was really surprised. They had a very large booth and a big number of these guitars in all sorts of different colors and designs, and it looks like D'Angelico is really going for it in a big way. Getting back to audio for a second, Manly Labs came out with the Force microphone preamp. The Force basically takes the mic amp from their core channel strip and put it into a box, but there's four of them. So for $2,500, you get four tube preamps from Manly, which is very reasonable. It's a very cool box. And, you know, again, four is a magic number when it comes to recording, because usually you want something like kick and snare and stereo overheads. So you want them all in the same style of preamp. Or maybe you'll want kick in, kick out, snare high, snare low, something like that. Or maybe you have four toms and you want them all to sound the same, so you have the same mics and the same preamps. So that's why four is important. And Manly Force has four of their core tube preamps in it. About $2,500. Very cool. Radar has been around for a long time. Radar has not only a great sounding digital audio workstation, but also has some very unique hardware. Back when there was the transition between tape machines and digital audio workstations, just about everybody that spent a lot of time in pro studios was used to the normal tape machine remote. You'd arm your tracks there, you had your transport controls there, and everybody was used to it. That was kind of like your right arm when you're recording. The transition to a workstation without that was very uncomfortable for a lot of people, but Radar actually made a transport control that was exactly like a normal tape transport control. So a lot of engineers, producers really liked it for that. Not only that, it sounded really good. That whole concept is kind of passé these days because we've all gotten used to being in the box so much that we don't need a remote so much, and there's all sorts of other remotes that we can get that are much more convenient that fit on a desktop. Nonetheless, Radar still makes it, but now they also make their own digital workstation that comes in their own box. In other words, it's not software that you tack onto a computer. It's in their own box with their own I.O. That said, a lot of people like the I.O., like the sound of their converters, but don't necessarily want to use their software. So now Radar has come out with their Studio, which allows you to also run other software on it, like Pro Tools if you want. And this comes with the normal Radar software, and it comes with Harrison's Mixbus software as well, if you want to use it. But basically, you can put any other software on that you want. So that's a pretty cool thing from Radar. A couple other things from Line 6. They have a new line of guitars, and the guitars are basically made by Yamaha. And of course, Yamaha acquired Line 6 about a year ago. Well, exactly a year ago, actually. So now what you're getting is a Yamaha guitar with the Line 6 emulation circuitry on board, which is very cool. It's a better feeling guitar. And again, they've refined their emulation software a lot. So there's actually two things. You can get all sorts of different guitar sounds, traditional guitar sounds, and you can also detune to just about any tuning that you want. So for instance, there's drop D, drop G, just about anything you can think of, Nashville tuning, and you can do it with the flick of a button. Okay, so that's cool in itself, but they also have a pedal that's called the Firehawk. And the Firehawk will allow you to add all sorts of interesting effects. Yes, Line 6 is noted for all that stuff. But now the integration between the guitar and the foot pedal is pretty much complete, where now it remembers all the settings on the guitar as well. So if you want to change suddenly to a Les Paul sound with the drop G tuning with some reverb and delay on it, you hit one button on the foot pedal, and both the guitar and the foot pedal and all the effects change at the same time. That's pretty cool. Not so much for the studio, but for live. It's really great. If you're trying to recreate what you've done in studio or just recreate what you've heard on a record if you're a copy band. Finally, one last item that I saw that I found very interesting. Roland came out with a little amplifier called the Blues Cube. It was like a 1x12 with a tweed cover, but that wasn't the interesting part. If you turn the unit around, you'd see what looked to be a tube that was glowing in the back. But it's not a tube. It's actually the firmware. So for instance, if you wanted the sound of Slash, for instance, well, you would put the Slash tone cube in. If you wanted Eric Johnson, I know they had Eric Johnson modeled software, firmware, you would put his tone cube in, and it would change the sound of your amplifier. Okay, here's the interesting part. And this may actually change the industry a little bit. You'd be surprised. Up until now, everyone has felt the software should be free. So in other words, if you bought a Blues Cube, you would feel that, okay, now I want to download the Slash firmware. And you'd connect your USB to your computer, go online, and download it. And a lot of companies would provide that for free. And if they charged for it, it usually wouldn't be one artist. It would be a lot of different artists. So you felt like you're getting your money's worth. Well, with these little cubes that they're offering, it's a way of actually charging for individual software. You think you're getting something because it looks like a little tube and it lights up like a tube and everything. So it feels like you're getting this tube that you plug in and the tones change. But actually what they're doing is they're charging you for software. So let's see if this becomes a trend in the business. I find it very intriguing that they would try something like this. But you have to hand it to a manufacturer trying to make a buck. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that a Blues Cube user is going to dig that so much. So anyway, that's the NAMM show. There's an awful lot going on. There's a lot of trends as usual. There's a lot of interesting products, although not as many as usual. It was kind of a sleepy show in terms of products. But that being said, there was a lot of enthusiasm in the show. It was one of the best shows I've seen in a long time where everybody felt good and everyone was upbeat. It seemed like there was money around and it just seemed like everyone was doing well. So in terms of that, I think the industry is doing pretty good and should feel pretty good about itself. Thank you for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Steve helps put this together. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.